Ready to roll into savings? Visit Dave Gill Chevrolet at 4700 East Broad Street in Columbus, your hometown Chevy experts. Right now, take advantage of tariff-busting deals on some of our most popular models. Experience the bold new 2025 Silverado 1500 with its powerful V8 engine and cutting-edge tech. Or discover the all-electric 2025 Chevy Equinox EV for an eco-friendly commute without compromising style or range. Looking for value? Browse our extensive inventory of certified pre-owned vehicles. From sporty coupes to family-friendly SUVs, each rigorously inspected for your peace of mind. Cruise over to Dave Gill Chevrolet or visit us online today at DaveGillChevy.com and drive home happy.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to Stars of the Golden Age, a show that highlights the lives of legends from film, music, and the birth of television during Hollywood's golden age and the few years surrounding it. I am your host, Erin Carlson. Today, we will be talking about Rock Hudson. I didn't realize it when I began my research and started writing the script of Rock Hudson's story, but this will be a two-part story. Today, I will talk about Rock Hudson's early life, his rise to stardom, and the first part of his movie career. And then I'll jump back in next week to talk about his later career and the heartbreaking end of his life. I've been getting pretty deep into my research lately, so you might see some more two-parters in the future here and there. I just want to really make sure that I'm honoring these people the way they deserve. And I just don't have enough hours in the week to put out episodes that are over an hour long each week. I wish I did, but we'll break it into two parts. Rock Hudson was, for a very long time, one of Hollywood's sexiest, most masculine, most desired men. Women wanted to be with him, men who couldn't at the time admit it out loud wanted to be with him, and every man wanted to be him. But Rock Hudson held on to secrets and a personal persona that were never to be allowed outside of his very small, very intimate social circle. Everyone felt like they knew Rock Hudson, but as it turned out, nobody really did. I want to say right off the top here that I'm only going to be focusing so much on Rock Hudson's sexuality throughout this episode because it really does matter to much of his story. Normally, I wouldn't speak so much about someone's sexual preferences because I really don't care who a person loves or sleeps with as long as they're happy. So the fact that Rock Hudson was gay or bi or whatever, well, that isn't really a defining aspect of any person that is at the top of my list. You know what I mean. Brown hair, blue eyes, tall, really nice, funny. All of those are things about a person that I would describe before saying that they're gay. Because people don't describe me as that hetero woman when they describe me to someone. But I will be talking about his sexuality like it is a big deal, because in Rock Hudson's story, it is a big deal. If Rock Hudson were rising the ranks of stardom today, we wouldn't be talking about his sexuality at all. But rising the ranks of stardom in 1950s America was a whole different ballgame. His sexuality, unfortunately, became the defining attribute of his memory. My goal today is to show you that there was so much more to Rock Hudson than something so minor as his sexuality. Rock Hudson was born Roy Harold Shearer Jr. on November 17, 1925, in Winnetka, Illinois, which is about 20 miles north of Chicago, right on Lake Michigan. Roy's parents were Kay, a homemaker, of course, and Roy Sr., a mechanic. Roy's mother Kay was described as large, overbearing, and my least favorite adjective to describe a woman, handsome. She was a tough cookie, and you did what Kay told you to do, or else. Roy Sr. was a heavy drinker, and not the fun kind. Little Roy was 6 years old when his father left. Roy Sr. packed a suitcase and snuck out of the house while his family was gone. No goodbye, no explanation, no opportunity to plead with him to stay. He just walked away to start a new life in California without his family during the Great Depression. Life was far from ideal living during the Great Depression, especially after Roy Sr. left. Kay and Roy Jr. moved in with family, living in a small one-bedroom home alongside four other children and five other adults. 11 members of one extended family living in one tiny, tiny home, barely scraping by. Regardless, the family was content and happy. They still managed to have a big family dinner every single night, and Grandma, only Grandma, would always eat her dessert first. Same, Grandma would. Sometimes dessert is my dinner. Kay did eventually remarry a man named Wally Fitzgerald. He became Roy's father, and Roy Shearer became Roy Fitzgerald. Actually, Kay married Wally, then divorced him, then married him again, and then divorced him again. Wally wasn't a very exceptional man. He was abusive. Not only would he mentally and physically abuse Kay, but he would take out any anger he had on Roy after arguments with his wife. He was also ashamed of Roy's physical appearance and personality, so he would beat him to, quote, try to make a man out of him. Roy was a very tall, very thin and lanky teenager. He grew to 6'4" in his teenage years and had yet to fill into that smoking hot body we all know of him later. He was happy but very shy around people that he wasn't very close with. He had a very small circle of close friends and was very close to his cousins. Aside from the abuse at home, Roy was also struggling with his sexuality. We have to remember we're talking about the late 1930s, early 1940s. Having romantic thoughts about someone of the same gender was very taboo. He didn't dare talk to anyone about it. That was the case for most gay people of the time. They had to bury that secret deep down and live the life expected of you, not the life you wanted. Roy didn't do very well in school and didn't participate in any sports or extracurricular activities. The family didn't have a lot of money, so he got an after-school job as soon as he was old enough. His mom was his best friend, and he wanted to do whatever he could to help her. She always worked so hard for him, and he wanted to take some of the stress off of her. So since he went to work so young, there was no time for school sports. He did learn how to play the piano by ear from his mother, though. They always had very special memories sitting together at the piano. Roy Fitzgerald entered the U.S. Navy in 1943 when he was 18 years old. It was the middle of World War II, and he was sent to serve on an airship in the Philippines. He later recalled the moment his ship sailed away from San Francisco as they left for the Philippines. Over the speakers played Sentimental Journey by Doris Day. He said the entire ship went silent and tears filled the eyes of every man on the ship. 18-year-old Roy Fitzgerald, of course, had no idea that the woman singing that song would become such a special person in his life and that he would be starring in Hollywood movies with her. The life of Roy Fitzgerald at the time couldn't have been farther away from a reality like that. Roy was discharged from the Navy in 1947 after his four-year enlistment ended. He returned to his hometown of Winnetka, Illinois, and he instantly knew he could not stay. The little boys of Winnetka were expected to live the entirety of their days in Winnetka and grow up to be firefighters and police officers. That wasn't the life Roy Fitzgerald wanted for himself. I do want to say that you can adore your hometown, but still want different things for your life. You may want the pages of your story to expand beyond the city limits of the town you grew up in and still hold that town at the centermost part of your heart. Roy Fitzgerald needed more in his story. He wanted to be an actor. 21-year-old Roy Fitzgerald arrived in Los Angeles, California in early 1947, and he was greeted there by the father who had walked out of his life 15 years earlier. Roy Sr. had remarried and adopted a daughter, and he wasn't too thrilled about having his estranged son bunking with them. He did get his son a job at his company, though, selling vacuum cleaners door to door. Poor Roy didn't sell a single vacuum. Man, I would have bought 5 vacuums from Rock Hudson just to get them in my house. Roy Jr. got a different job and was making enough money to move into a boarding house out of his dad's house. He also discovered the gay community in Long Beach, and he couldn't believe it. A whole community of people who were open about their sexuality. Open and free. He would never see something like this in the Midwest, he thought. It was through this new community that Roy met his first romantic partner, a 36-year-old man named Ken Hodge, a former producer for Lux Radio Theater. Ken is responsible for getting Roy in for headshots to start sending to agents. And they began sending his headshot to every agent in town. The first one to reply to him was a talent agent named Henry Wilson. Let's sidetrack over to Henry Wilson's sexually abusive track for a minute. This man was known for his skill in grooming and transforming young unknown hopeful actors, all men, into buff, sexy, well-groomed, masculine gods. He taught them how to dress, how to speak, how to walk, what to drink, what muscles to flex, and who to sleep with. Guess who that always was? Him, Henry Wilson. Henry Wilson took advantage of these young men, much the same way that was commonplace with women in the offices of Harry Cohn and Louis B. Mayer over at the big studios. He took them in and promised them a movie star life for the small price of sex with him. I talked about Henry Wilson in my History of the Casting Couch bonus episode. In that episode, I shared a quote from actor Roddy McDowall, who described Henry Wilson like this. Quote, "Like the slime that oozed out from under a rock you did not want to turn over," end quote. Rock's dear friend George Nader said of Wilson, "He exuded evil." Henry Wilson was a sexual predator. He was a rapist. He used his position of power to manipulate men into sexual relationships, and if anyone threatened to expose him or not do as he said, he would counter it by threatening them with outing them. Who had more to lose? The established talent agent or the struggling unknown actor? Who would people believe? We must remember, it was illegal to be gay in the United States. Homosexuality was viewed as a mental illness, an illegal mental illness. Lives could be ruined with one phone call. I'm sure some of the men who walked through the doors of Henry Wilson's office were indeed gay or bi, but I doubt very many of them actually wanted to have sex with him. Henry Wilson was not a great man, but he did have a huge role in Rock Hudson's rise to stardom. In fact, it was Henry Wilson who transformed not only the image of Roy Fitzgerald, but his name as well. Roy Fitzgerald became Rock Hudson in the office of Henry Wilson. With Henry Wilson's help, in 1948, Hudson was offered a 7-year contract with Universal Studios in their Contract Players training program. He was thrilled at this opportunity for growth and a regular paycheck. In 1951, Henry Wilson introduced Rock Hudson to an aspiring actor named Bob Preble. They were quickly a couple and living together in a 1-bedroom bungalow. Of course, translated to 1951 speak, that would be, they were two of the most eligible bachelors carousing the town together, and they never let the party stop by residing together in the manliest of bachelor pads. Photoplay magazine did a big spread on this relationship and an intimate look into their bachelor pad. It was very similar to the one done of Cary Grant and Randolph Scott, an attempt to bring awareness to this unusual living situation, but play it off as nothing but a couple of cool, woman-loving dudes saving a buck by living under one roof together. I should mention there are varying accounts to this relationship, but most point to it being a romantic relationship. It's just another example of how secret same-sex relationships had to be in those days, and how discreet Rock Hudson was with his private life. Also in 1951, Rock Hudson met two men who became very important figures in his life, George Nader and his partner Mark Miller. These two men would remain Hudson's closest confidants for the remainder of his life, up until his very last moments on Earth. The 1954 Douglas Sirk film Magnificent Obsession was the vehicle that drove Rock Hudson into superstardom. Prior to that film, he'd been placed in a lot of cheesy adventure-type films. But after producer Ross Hunter cast him as the romantic lead in Magnificent Obsession, Rock Hudson was soon the man of Hollywood. He was the definite king of Universal. He was hot. Douglas Sirk quickly grabbed onto Rock Hudson for his unique brand of movies. Sirk had a very specific signature style in filmmaking. Everything was vivid and bright and beautiful from the outside, but under the surface was always imperfection. Sirk went on to cast Hudson in 9 of his movies. I really loved a quote from the documentary, Rock Hudson, All That Heaven Allowed, about the movie All That Heaven Allows. Actor and author Alina Douglas says, quote, "Rock Hudson is just a perfect example of a male hedonist, but he's also a sensitive, well-rounded guy. He's not strictly a sex object. He's the perfect man for the woman of that era. That maybe were trapped in lonely marriages with insensitive, unfeeling men. Rock Hudson is playing Rock Hudson, who is the personification of Americana. The identity was given to him, and he slipped into it and played it for the rest of his life." End quote. Rock continued to live a quiet life as a gay man and dated several men. Sometimes he would get a little serious, and sometimes it was just a fun fling. He was just happy to be somewhat able to live his true self, at least in his own home or in the local gay community. Former lover Jack Navar shared a really sad truth about living life as a gay man in 1950s America. He said they had to have special codes for sharing any kind of affection outside of their private havens. 1, 2, 3 was their code. It meant, "I love you." Jack recalled that it could come in the form of tapping on the countertop 3 times, giving the other 3 little nudges, or simply saying, 1, 2, 3. They weren't welcome to say, "I love you" around very many people, so they were forced to use codes. And when Rock Hudson very proudly arrived at the Westwood Theater for the premiere of Magnificent Obsession on May 11, 1954, for his first dramatic role, the role that made him a star, he had to do so with a woman on his arm, and his boyfriend Jack had to arrive in a different car with a woman also on his arm. They would have loved to enjoy this wonderful moment together, but that just wasn't possible in 1954. Rock Hudson was very generous and very kind-hearted to his romantic partners. He not only helped them out financially, but he helped their families. He put his boyfriend's siblings through college. He sent monthly checks to boyfriend's mothers. He had a good heart, and he knew what it was like to financially struggle. Rock Hudson turned 30 years old in November of 1955, and for some reason that the Universal Studio heads could not figure out, he was not married and had no intention of settling down with any woman anytime soon. This was cute and all when he was a young, hot 20-something bachelor, but almost 30? Come on, Rock Hudson. So they started pushing women into his arms. They'd have gossip magazines publish pictures and stories of him with young, beautiful starlets, make it look like he was really busy with the ladies. The sleaziest of the gossip magazines, Confidential, threatened to out Hudson and publish a tell-all story of his secret sexual life. It really became a hot topic around town as to why Rock Hudson wasn't wearing a wedding ring at the elderly age of 29 years old. And then finally, Rock Hudson got married. If this doesn't scream lavender marriage, I don't know what does. His new wife was his agent Henry Wilson's secretary. Rock Hudson married Phyllis Gates on November 9th, 1955, 8 days before his 30th birthday. Cutting it close, geezer. Just to give you a little idea of what kind of woman Phyllis Gates was, here's what Rock's boyfriend Jack LaVar had to say about her. Quote, "She knew how to make a guy feel fabulous. She was much more attractive in person than her photographs. She had a marvelous laugh and an incredible personality. You'd meet her, and in 10 minutes, you'd feel you were the most important person in her life. It was a talent, end quote. Rock Hudson had similar things to say about Phyllis. It sounds like she was really, really fun to be around. She was fun, funny, personable, confident, and just had one of those personalities that drew everyone in. She was a Minnesota girl, of course she was awesome. Well, the marriage only lasted 2 years. Shocking, I know. It wasn't meant to be. Those awesome things Rock said about her, he said it all ended the day they got married. Listen, I would love for them to have been madly in love when they got married and to have had a long several months of passion and joy as newlyweds. But I think it's safe to say that wasn't the situation. Henry Wilson clearly organized a lavender marriage for his number one star, and his poor little secretary from Minnesota was pulled in for the ride. But hey, at least she got to be married to Rock Hudson. In fact, Henry Wilson started with a little different plan. He first used Phyllis to lure Jack away from Rock, to spend time with Jack and drive a wedge between him and Rock. It wasn't only because of this, but Rock and Jack did ultimately split up shortly before Rock and Phyllis were married. It was rumored later on that Phyllis was also closeted bi, and Jack did tell biographer Sarah Davidson later that he witnessed her in relationships with women. I don't know, it's just really sad that anyone had to do that. That people couldn't just openly love who they wanted to love without either losing their career, being stoned in the street, or being locked in jail. Phyllis Gates actually wrote a book about her relationship with Rock Hudson a couple of years after his death. I haven't read the book, but from what I've heard of it, she claims to have had absolutely no idea she was married to a gay man. She claims she was set up to marry Rock Hudson and thought she was getting into a real romantic marriage. But by the time of their marriage, just about everyone working in Hollywood already assumed Rock Hudson was gay. A lot of people in the film business were gay. It was accepted within those circles. It was the public they had to worry about. So it's hard to believe she didn't know what she was getting into. When they divorced, just 3 years after they married, Phyllis fought for a huge financial settlement. And she got it. It left Rock Hudson almost broke. See, we should just let gay people marry who they want to marry and not force them into fake marriages. Look what it does. Then came Giant in 1956 with Elizabeth Taylor and James Dean. James Dean's final film. Rock Hudson said he didn't particularly like James Dean. There was a personality clash there. And Dean was quoted as saying the same. But Rock Hudson loved Elizabeth Taylor. And she him. Elizabeth Taylor was known for her close friendships with gay men throughout her life. Here's a cute story about the sprouting of Rock Hudson and Elizabeth Taylor's friendship at the beginning of filming for Giant. Elizabeth invited Rock and Phyllis over for dinner. She was married to Michael Wilding at the time, so they could get to know each other a little better since they were playing husband and wife in such an epic story. So Rock and Phyllis had dinner at Elizabeth and Michael Wilding's home, and drinks, of course. And a few cocktails into the night, Rock said to Elizabeth, "How can you stand being so beautiful?" She laughed and said, "Beautiful? Beautiful? I'm Minnie Mouse." She went into her bedroom, changed into a red skirt and black pumps, pinned her hair back, and returned to the living room. "It was true," Rock recalled. There stood Minnie Mouse. Rock Hudson and Elizabeth Taylor had to be at the studio at 6 a.m. the next day. They stayed up drinking and laughing until 4 a.m. They were going to get along just fine. They both had the worst hangovers ever the next day during filming. They had little nicknames for each other, too. Rock called Elizabeth Taylor Bessie, and she called Rock Rockabye. They had a very magical connection with each other and just had so much fun together. While filming in Texas for Giant, they lived in rented homes next to each other and spent all of their free time together. Now, Mom, listen very closely to this part. While in Texas shooting Giant, Rock Hudson and Elizabeth Taylor claimed to have invented the chocolate martini. My mom loves chocolate martinis and espresso martinis, everyone. They claim to have had a buzzed up idea one night. They both loved vodka martinis and they both loved chocolate. So why not combine the two? So they started with a basic vodka martini and mixed in a little chocolate liqueur and chocolate syrup and bam, one delicious cocktail. Brock Hudson's home from 1960 until the end of his life was affectionately named The Castle. Let me describe The Castle a little to you, as described by biographer Sarah Davidson. It had two living rooms, two front doors, a theater with a real stage and footlights, a steam room, a gym, a pool, four fireplaces, six ice makers, and a grand staircase. Sounds just like my house. Well, maybe not exactly. The castle was a classic Spanish-style house, a large house, with stucco walls and a red-tiled roof. It had beautiful stone arch patio spaces, wonderful for entertaining. Rock Hudson undertook a huge renovation project on the home that lasted for several years, and the finished product was his own perfect personal haven, his heaven on earth. It was filled with beautiful hand-painted tiles and had ceilings made of tree branches designed in a diagonal pattern. You could find all kinds of different colors and textures in Rock Hudson's home. Zebra skins, lots of natural elements, big Spanish wood doors, African masks, and lots of various animal statues. One of his friends affectionately described it as early Butch. The castle sat atop its own personal peninsula on 3.5 acres of land with cliffs on three sides. The view was stunning. Still is. The home is stunning now, but it's no longer Rock Hudson's castle. Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen bought the home in 1992 and demolished most of the original home, building a 24,300-square-foot super mansion with a current estimate of $36.5 million. Rock Hudson loved his home. He said, quote, "My house is the only place I really have any privacy. Outside the house, everything I do is watched and talked about. But once I come home in these gates, I can relax and let go. I love to work on my house, to tear down walls and lay bricks. And for real relaxation, there's nothing like gardening. When I'm thinking about my career decisions and working out new roles in my head, I like to go out in the garden and sweat. If I had to do it all over again, I'd probably be a landscape architect," end quote. He loved gardening so much. It brought him so much joy, peace, and pride. With the help of his gardener, who lived at the castle too, he grew flowers, fruits, and vegetables. He had a greenhouse devoted to his prized orchids. Orchids are hard. He grew mint for juleps, limes for daiquiris, and peaches for ice cream. Rock also loved to be surrounded by friends, trusted friends. His small staff, like the gardener, his housekeeper, and his personal secretary, were like family to him. In fact, his personal secretary was one of his oldest Hollywood friends, Mark Miller, who I mentioned previously. Miller was down on his luck at a time, so Rock employed him. And he became Rock Hudson's closest confidant. Mark and his longtime partner, George Nader, lived at the castle, so they were all just one happy family. Rock sometimes enjoyed solitude, but mostly he wanted to be around his friends and his chosen family. He loved to read, he loved music, and he loved long, meaningful conversations. Biographer Sarah Davidson wrote, quote, "To his friends, Rock had possessed something unique, the ability to make them laugh as no one else could. He was childlike and silly and broke people up. He laughed until tears ran down his cheeks and took special delight in laughing and making people laugh when they weren't supposed to. His deep, rippling laugh and tall body shaking with mirth were infectious. Actress after actress told me she'd never had more fun on a stage, more helpless fits of hysteria than with Rock. Most of us can laugh and play like this with one or two people, but Rock could do it with everyone, young and old, women and men. The gift, the twinkle, resided in him," end quote. Rock Hudson treasured time with his very tight circle of friends. They never really went out on the town, but they hung out at Rock's gorgeous home or at his friend's place in Laguna Beach. One of his friends recalled that they spent a lot of time at the gay beach in Laguna, and that it was the one place where they all felt so free and happy, and that they had a lot of really great times there. They could be open there, and they were so happy. One thing that seemed to be pretty consistent amongst Rock Hudson's closest friends, though, is that he was very, very unpredictable. Just when they thought they had him figured out, he would surprise them somehow. He was known to fabricate stories and keep truths hidden. He shared most of his self with his inner circle, but I don't think he ever really shared himself with anyone. I'm going to share a quote Rock made describing himself a little. He said, quote, "I love to smoke. I keep hoping someone will discover it's a healthy habit because the smoke kills all the germs in our system. I love to drink and I hate exercise. I don't mind going out on the side of a hill and chopping down a tree, but I hate organized exercise. I built a gym in my house, but I never use it. I don't even like to walk through it. I'm a night person. When I'm not working, I never want to go to sleep. I'd much rather stay up and talk or read and play music. Music is real important in my life, like air. I need it to breathe. I like to be surrounded by music all the time, and I like all kinds." End quote. One of my favorite things I learned about Rock Hudson was that he loved Christmas, and he personally shopped for and wrapped each and every gift that he bought for the people in his life. And he bought gifts for a lot of people. He was a great gift giver. He would really listen to people and then get them the perfect gift going by what he observed in their conversations. He did this for all of his friends and coworkers. At Christmas time, he would transform his rec room into a gift wrapping room where he would spend hours wrapping presents. I'm sure listening to music. He loved it. Rock Hudson first co-starred with Doris Day in 1959 in the cute romantic comedy Pillow Talk. Quite a step away for Rock from his Douglas Sirk movies and from Giant. He and Doris Day had an instant connection and soon had cute little nicknames for each other just like he and Elizabeth Taylor had. Rock called Doris Eunice because it just made him laugh to think of her as a Eunice. And Doris called Rock Ernie because he's certainly no Rock, she said. Doris and Rock made each other laugh so much that it took several extra takes to complete a lot of their scenes. Rock Hudson said Pillow Talk was one of his favorite movies of his career and said this of working with Doris Day. Quote, "I love the comedies. I got to learn from Doris. Talk about knowing your craft. If I have to do a comedy with, say, Shelley Winters, that's hard labor. She's not funny, and she thinks she is. She's got a voice that goes right through you. To try to do a comedy with someone who has no conception of what comedy is, that's a killer. But Doris knows," end quote. Pillow Talk was a smash hit, and they went on to do two more movies together. They adored each other so much. That's where I'm going to leave off on Rock Hudson's story for this week. Please don't forget to tune back in next week to hear the rest of Rock Hudson's story. Before we go, I want to share a review of the week. This review was shared on Apple Podcasts a long time ago, actually. I think it was last July. This was actually my first review, which automatically makes it very, very special. That's when I knew strangers were actually listening to me yap away, not just people I knew. This review is from Eric Lee, host of This Is How We See It podcast. He wrote, "I am a fellow podcaster, This Is How We See It, and a huge fan of classic movies. I love this podcast because it takes me deeper into the private lives of the stars of the Golden Age. I love the knowledge you bring to these actors and actresses of the past. Great job." Thank you again, Eric, and right back at you. I've listened to Eric's podcast, and you guys should check it out too. He talks about some really important current events in a nice, casual way, and his voice is very calming. This is How We See It. If you want to hear your review read on the show, you gotta leave one. Also, please visit patreon.com/starsofthegoldenagepodcast to learn about the fun bonus content available there. Come on over and join the fun. Don't forget to tune back next week to hear the rest of Rock Hudson's story. Thanks, guys. My primary source for this episode was the book Rock Hudson, His Story by Sarah Davidson and Rock Hudson. I also watched the documentary Rock Hudson, All That Heaven Allowed, available on Netflix, amfair.org, a smidge from Wikipedia, and IMDb.
Want to keep your personal number private but still stay connected? With Line 2, you can get a second phone line right on your device with a super simple app and no need for another phone. Whether it's for online shopping, dating, or shielding your main number from spam, Line 2 is an easy way to manage it all. Ready for peace of mind without breaking the bank? Call, text, block, and more for only $9.99. Get started with line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in any app store today. Line 2, your second line simplified.